Hi, Bobby Halton here for our sponsor, Unimac. Hey, Unimac wants to remind you to take care of your crew with the most complete PPE cleaning solution in the industry. With washer extractors built for maximum performance tailored to NFPA 1851 standards, simple record-keeping capabilities, and free training for your entire firehouse, it's no wonder that Unimac is called on by fire crews across the nation.
Learn more at unimac.com/safe solution.
Welcome to the Command Show.
Titan 5, Engine 101.
With Anthony Castros and Ed Hadfield. Let's start the show.
Hey, everybody. Anthony Castros coming to you live from California. It is 4:30 local time. And we are here on another edition of the Command Show. And I've got a lot of information for you out there. I know a lot of you listen to this podcast after the fact because you listen to a recording maybe while you're working out or on your drive. So thank you for that. If any of you are listening and want to call in and ask questions, the number to call in is 760-454-8852. Now, I'm excited because we've got some changes coming up, a lot of classes coming up, a lot of training, and there's much to share tonight. And before I do, I'm going to start this show like we do every single show. That's to talk about the NIOSH 5, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. The NIOSH 5 is the top five operational causes of line-of-duty deaths. Now, this is not the same as asphyxiation or heart attacks or vehicle accidents and burns and trauma and things like that. Those are the physiological reasons of line-of-duty death. The NIOSH 5 are the operational causes that lead up to those things. And it's not just line-of-duty death, but these are certainly the factors that drive near misses, significant injuries that would include time off, and also just sloppy, dysfunctional fire ground operations that often lead to civilians lost and or exorbitant fire losses. So it's five things. Number one is inadequate or improper risk assessment. Number two is inadequate and improper communications. The next one is lack of good accountability. And number four is lack of good incident command, not using the incident command system to your advantage. And finally, not having SOGs or not following your SOGs. So those are the top five. Those really, when you start to see those things line up on your incident, whether it's a structure fire, a vegetation fire, an MCI or a hazmat, whatever it is, if you see those five things start to line up and you have problems in those five areas and they line up, you're going to have a potentially catastrophic problem in your fire. A mayday, perhaps a near miss, perhaps exorbitant losses and or injuries, which we hope and pray doesn't happen. So these are the warning signs. So with that, I'd like to make a major announcement tonight, and that is that my dear friend and colleague Ed Hadfield is no longer going to be part of the Command Show. He has been very busy being a fire chief out here in California, and he has graciously stepped down because of his busy schedule, which has allowed us to bring on somebody who is a dear friend and colleague who I find to be incredibly wise and insightful and knowledgeable and passionate. And that is Battalion Chief Brian Brush from Midwest City. So I'd like to officially welcome him as my co-host. Brian, welcome to the show, brother.
Man, thanks, Chief. I'm pretty excited about this. It's, you know, the training that we've been a part of and working together to bring that to another platform to message on is going to be pretty cool. So I'm excited. And as the role of a new co-host, I've decided to take full opportunity and use this to pick our first guest and highlight the Oklahoma Fire Service on the show.
Well, I think that's a great idea, and that's a good thing. Before you do, why don't we remind the listeners what you and I have been working on together as far as teaching classes and what you've been working on for a long, long time that's hopefully hopefully helping steer the fire service in our mission in the future. Go ahead and share all your stuff with them for a little bit.
Yeah, that's absolutely the Firefighter Rescue Survey. The information that's kind of been put out by that, firefighterrescuesurvey.com, is what started us kind of having our conversation about incorporating that type of information into your command program. And, you know, been working through it. I've been doing more and more research on it. We've been trying to get some things tightened up on the IT side of Firefighter Rescue Survey. And then also the joint class at FDIC is really what has started to contribute that research and then application to the field from our two perspectives. So thankful that Fire Engineering allowed us to do that class last year as kind of a chance to fill a spot that had been created, and they've invited us back next year, so we'll be able to do that program at FDIC 2022 as well.
Yeah, I'm excited about that, brother. Bobby Halton was gracious enough to add us to the conference, to the classroom sessions. It was standing room only. It was great to have everybody there. And you know what we're doing is we're not talking about anything more than civilian rescue, and we're not talking about detracting from the other important tactics on the fire ground. When we say civilian rescue, we do not mean not putting water on the fire. We do not mean not talking about ventilation or medical. We're talking about all of it. Civilian rescue it needs everything. It needs fire attack. It needs good, aggressive, and appropriate search and rescue. It needs medical and needs probably ventilation to enhance the environment, because the fire ground and the fires are moving at an exponential rate. And if we don't outpace the incident will outpace us, and the people that hang in the balance are our civilians. And so this is not about running into a building with no hose line or not thinking about a hose line. It's not heads or tails. These are not mutually exclusive goals. The ultimate goal is to save civilian lives, and that includes fire attack, rescue, vent, and medical. I've been saying that for many years. And I think what we're trying to do is give additional information. I think the work you've done with your team at Firefighter Rescue Survey has really enlightened the American Fire Service on specific data that's both qualitative and quantitative that can tell us things about rescues and tactics and time frames in which to perform a rescue, and which that helps us with our tactical decision making. And so I want to talk about that later on. But without further ado, I'd like you to introduce your first guest to our show and kind of talk about what a beautiful article he wrote that I think is in concert with what we're teaching.
Yeah, and just to kind of set it up, I mean, your talk right there about the rescues and getting those groups going so that things can be handled. Solutions can be developed as close to the problem as possible. We trust that our firefighters are educated and trained, and in those moments when things are developing too fast for traditional communication or control models, we got to decentralize. And I know that's a tenet of your program is decentralizing command by using divisions and groups and getting those problem solvers closer. And who we'll be speaking with tonight is a Captain Mike Emilio from Oklahoma City Fire Department, and just wrote a great article in Fire Engineering, and I'll have to have him remind us of which month it was so you guys can look it up. But he frames it a little bit differently about decentralized idea making, and I really latched onto that because I think it's a great, you know, a lot of times we get kind of top-down or bottom-up acceptance, and I think by highlighting the solution into the problem, and as he'll, you know, talk about getting those tailboarders involved and contributing to the conversation, that decentralized idea making is just, I think, such a great frame of reference for that, not just decentralized command and having it still coming from the top, but kind of a message of a bottom up. So, Mike, welcome to the show. We are certainly excited to hear what you have to say. Why don't you give us a little bit of background on where you're currently assigned, what you're doing, and how this article came to fruition for you.
Oh, thank you very much for the intro. And I'm Mike Emilio. I've been almost 20 years with the Oklahoma City Fire Department, GO 0201, that's graduating class. Started early on with the in the kind of rescue disciplines and things like that, and it has primarily hovered around Station 8, where I currently am the station officer. I've been lucky enough to have served all the ranks from firefighter to driver to now station officer here at Station 8. So I'm very lucky in that regard. And I'm exceedingly proud to be maybe the first or the inaugural guest on the Brian Brush era as it starts. So that's pretty cool. Thank you all for having me.
It's our pleasure, brother. Could you tell us more about your article? The reason why we wanted to have you on the show is because your article was just really spot on regarding decentralized decision making. And some people don't know what that means. It's a term that's been around forever. It's a philosophy that's been around forever, but it has had a hard time in the fire service, because as we go around to our command workshops, we find that the folks that have been doing this a long time have a hard time letting go of that command and control, if you will. And I honestly think control is an illusion. I think it's a misnomer. Nobody has control from the command post. You're too far away. I don't care if you're staying on the front lawn or the front yard or on the driveway. You don't have control. The incident is too dynamic. There's too many moving parts that you can't see from one spot. And what we've noticed is that the old methodology of centralized command, which is everyone reporting to the incident commander, really is an outdated, somewhat of an outdated system, in that the incidents move too fast now, and decisions have to be made in real time. And with as many resources as we have coming to the modern day incidents, with the advent of two out and RIC and medical and two and three line fires, what was once a two engine, one truck incident is now a five engine, three truck, two chief, one medic, first alarm, let alone additional rescue or hazmat companies. The department we were teaching this past week, they had on a house fire, they would get four engines, two trucks, a medic unit, a hazmat unit, a rescue unit, and two chiefs. And for those of you doing the math, that span of control is way blown out. And centralized decision making and or centralized command is the notion that everyone has to report to command. Command makes the decisions through one radio frequency instead of decentralizing the decision making. So with that as the backdrop, tell us about your work and your article and what you discovered and what you're thinking.
Yes, sir, Chief. I've worked with some real giants here at the fire department in Oklahoma City, and people that I love and respect immensely. And kind of to a man, I think that if they were given the opportunity to explain their methods, some of them are deemed kind of infallible. They never make mistakes, if they were given the opportunity to kind of speak to that, I think that they all to a person would say that they're not as gifted at decision making as we make them out to be in a way. They're just capable of taking in information as it presents itself, and they kind of welcome that information and then turn it into actionable tactics. I think that this humility stems from the fact that we all know that there will be, if not tonight, maybe next shift, a problem that as a commanding officer we can't solve, and we'll have to heavily rely on the people around us. I think that, his name was General Van Riper. He's a U.S. Marine Corps general, and he defeated a force of technologically advanced United States military staff in a war game, and he did it by being, in his words, in command but out of control. He had total command of the operation, but he just allowed the experience and the skill set of his underlings to make the thing move forward, and he had great success with it.
I love that term, in command, out of control. It goes to what I said earlier about the fact that control is an illusion. You know, in command, or command and control classes are a bit of an illusion. And to your point, we have learned from giants. You know, we are standing on the shoulders of giants who've come before us, who were able to, at least from where we were sitting, manage multiple resources, be ahead of the curve, stay calm on the radio, manage multiple frequencies, manage second alarms, and do it with ease. And it came from experience. And the challenge that we seem to be having now with the next generation is we need to replicate that skill set, but we need to do it in a different way. And that comes through training and decentralizing through the incident command system. And I love what you said about in command, out of control.
Yeah. Mike, I thought it was, you know, and you kind of brought it up a little bit before we started the show, and obviously Chief Castro's definitely focuses on the full incident spectrum as far as using divisions and groups to break up that span of control. But you talked a little bit about it at the company level and as a station officer and the company level, and that's something that I certainly found value in working at West Metro on a heavy rescue or on the truck with four people. Just the ability to split our crew up to do two separate tasks. And a lot of times that came down to trusting the two guys behind us as firefighters to operate as an independent team, knowing that they could act faster than the guys getting out of the front seat, getting packed up and just kicking down that team of work down to two guys who maybe not be formally promoted, but certainly capable of making those decisions. So you kind of led with talking about the decentralized idea making and that coming from you as a company officer. You want to expand on that at all?
Yes, sir. Yeah, you know, I remember a time when we were sitting around the firehouse, and lo and behold, it was later in the evening, just sitting around watching TV, I think, and we have a Marine that is stationed with us, and he just stood upright and said, "I heard gunshots," and we went outside and heard some hollering a couple blocks away, and 2 minutes later, we're at a multi-patient shootout, rather. And I remember getting off the rig and feeling, for whatever reason, this particular scene, it just kind of, I didn't freeze, I just was kind of acutely focused on the wrong stuff. And around me, the guys on the rig were immediately going to work. They immediately knew what to do, and eventually it sort of primed me, and I took my role in the scene, and we did the thing, you know, to fine effect. It was just, I realized that there are times that I relied so heavily on that back step or my driver to keep me engaged, so to speak, because I do have the same lapse in focus that we probably all share to some point or another. I felt like it was, you know, no one on the fire ground is going to care for my crew the way I do. I try to incorporate every member of my crew on the fire ground. I try to use all the ideas that are given to me by them, and I try to express care for them in everything they do. It's one of the things that I think is kind of the key focus of this decentralized idea making, is that you give that officer the kind of autonomy to take the scene as he sees it, where he sees it, he or she sees it, and to address it with tactics that are appropriate and probably have been trained on multiple times prior to the event. The first comment I got when the article dropped was something to the effect of, "So what you're suggesting is freelancing," and that's exactly the opposite of what I'm suggesting. I think that the system has to work as a whole, and in order for there to be trust in the station officer from command and vice versa from the crew up to the up to command. It has to be trained on with, you know, incredible reps and effort. So I think that is where I, as a station officer, fit into the situation. I can come with a team full of people. I've got we ride four on our engine company, so I show up with eight eyeballs and four brains, and all of that history and all of that experience and all of those skill sets, and I feel very confident that we can solve problems.
So the trust that you gained with your crew that gets tested on the fire ground is built around the station and on the drill ground, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah. I feel like, you know, we are all hopefully students of this job. And when we go out to train, which we do, we're a specialty house, so we like to do a fire day. We're the dive house, so we do a water day and then a fire day on our three-day tour.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are – each day kind of comes with – the day of the week has a theme, so to speak, and we try to tackle problems together so that we act in concert when we get on scene. It's not that I want anyone to necessarily go off and do their own thing. I want to know what's going on, but I am fully aware that if we're doing our 360 we're an active writ and we're doing our 360, and one of my guys says, hey, I want to throw a ladder to that second division window, and there is no reason that they shouldn't. I want them to feel free to bring that to me. And I likewise want to feel the freedom to take an issue to, say, the chief, such as, hey, we just finished our 360 and there is a searchable space in the rear of this structure. Or even to, again, as the article addressed, if I'm going in on RIT, our script kind of reads engine 8, making entry on the alpha side. We have four greens, meaning all of our members have full bottles, and I activate a secondary RIT. You know, that takes that component off of command's plate. It's one less thing that command has to remember. And I just feel like it's me caring for the guy who's caring for me.
There you go. I love that. And that's exactly what it is. And as you're talking, I'm thinking about, you know, incident management teams and how this relates. For those of you joining us, we're talking to Captain Mike Emilio from the Oklahoma City Fire Department and our new co-host, Brian Brush from Midwest City Fire. We're talking about decentralized decision-making and civilian rescue tonight. And, you know, as you're talking, it's a team effort, right? Centralized command says, hey, the incident commander is the boss. Everyone else is working under the incident commander and who has the ultimate authority. Decentralized command says, hey, we're an incident management team. Just like a type 1, 2, or 3 incident management team shows up, and everyone has their role, and they divide the authority and the responsibility to make decisions into specific functions or geographic areas. The same thing happens on a single alarm or multi-alarm structure fire, but those are just type 4 or type 5 incident management teams. They're called alarms. First alarm, second alarm, third alarm, whatever it is, it's an incident management team nonetheless. And a company officer should be able to fulfill the incident command role, if he or she is first on scene or second on scene, assuming command from a company officer ahead of them. They should be able to fulfill a division or group tactical position, or they should certainly be able to fulfill their task level supervision of their crew. And so in some cases, all three in the same incident based on the incident and the sequence of arrival. But to your point, it takes time and training to build the trust that's required for that team to arrive and cohesively put aside ego, put aside competition, put aside beating each other in, but working together for the greatest outcome of everybody. And that includes decentralizing the decision making. So what are some things that you find in particular that make for a better information process or decision making on the fire ground with this methodology?
Well, you know, I guess some of the things are directly addressing the, as you started with, the NIOSH 5. I mean, everything from a proper size up to give everybody inbound kind of a realization of what's occurring to, and that process should obviously continue on throughout the fire alarm. But then, of course, communication is the big thing for me. I want my guys to be ready to, you know, we practice dressing, you know, just like anything else. And I want my guys to be ready and capable of just hitting the ground running so that we can use every second that we saved getting ready to affect something positively on the fire ground. And I am just as I'm just as dedicated to RIT as I am to rescue. It's as big a deal to me to make sure that everything I do, everything my crew does, we all feel the same, that everything we do on the outside is for the person on the inside, or our people on the inside, and or the victim. And so it goes through that pride in kind of task work and then of course communication on the rig. I want all those sets of eyes to be looking in the same direction and or scanning in the same direction so that they can give me everything they see when they feel it's necessary. Just listen to Mayday Monday from the Buffalo incident with Chief Lombardo. And, you know, communication was such a huge, huge deal there in that event. I really think that's going to have – that may be the biggest impact that idea-making can have. It's, you know, having a set up organization where you know that here we've started to attack the fire on tank water because we're so covered up, in particularly in my area, that the second due engine is right on our heels. So that second line comes very quickly, or the stretch line from the plug comes very quickly, and we get to work something that we've repeated over and over again. The truck company, when they're told to assess for ventilation, they can take the initiative and decide based on what they see as to whether they're going to the roof or if they're going to start horizontally, you know, ventilating. These are all things that through the size up and communications aspects of decentralized idea making, these are all things that can happen flawlessly with a kind of a head start if we train on them and or attend you know, multiple events together.
You know, Mike, I think you bring up a good point there, too, and that's kind of always what people discuss as well. Is this encouraging freelancing, or is this, you know, you're taking the boss out of the loop on what's going on? But I think, like you're discussing there a little bit, is that in that training and establishing trust, there's also kind of expectations that are set. You know, here's the parameters we want you to work within. You know, when I say assess for ventilation, you know, I'm letting you guys come up with the best plan. But then you communicate your plan back to me. I'm trusting that based on what you're seeing, that's what's going to work best, and I'm just going to let you go. But I think that is, you know, expectations, but then also accountability. We hold ourselves accountable to our own goals probably more than anybody else. So when you as a crew take a look at something and say, yeah, I think we can get this done, you tell the chief we're going to the roof, we think we need a hole here and here, you know, all right, go ahead. You guys now kind of have that ownership in that plan. So I think there's it's like that continuing the conversation. Decent. We don't want to just have, it's not fire ground by committee, you know, it's within these parameters, within these boundaries, this is what we want you to accomplish, but we're not going to drill down into the weeds as far as what tools you guys are using.
Yeah. You know, it really, it's so satisfying to operate with a group of people that that are on page. It's something that when you get on a scene that kind of flows by itself, it really makes you realize that those hours spent training together and those kind of ad nauseum almost, it really makes the payoff kind of special. You know, I feel like there's an opportunity for Command to become to have more of a presence if those things are through proper communication. If that idea making is allowed to expand, it paints a better picture for Command, and the end result is the command of the thing is always going to be Command's responsibility. I never see a reason that Command would have to fold to this decentralized decision making or idea making rather. I just feel like it gives them more information to address what's in front of them.
Well, it certainly does that, and that's, you know, specifically we talk about how modern fires move more rapidly. They reach their flashover state. The victims have less time to survive and less time to wait for us to get in and get them out. And information's coming at you so fast. To tether everybody to one radio frequency where they have to stand in line and ask for permission to do everything while they stand in line while everyone else is getting orders ahead of them, it really slows the crew down. It slows the alarm down, and the fire will outpace us. Versus an exponential approach that says, hey, we all have leader's intent. The leader's intent is the task, purpose, and end state. We all know our SOGs. We've all trained. We all trust each other. Go out, and I'm going to ask for feedback. I'm going to ask for a size up from the rear. I'm going to ask for tactical ideas, and I'm going to empower you potentially as a division or group tactical supervisor to go beyond that even and just run your area without even telling me what you're doing. As long as it's in concert with the strategy and the overall priority of the incident, and as long as it's meeting the intent and the objectives of your group or division, then you don't have to tell me. You know, if you choose to do VES on the Charlie side as a division Charlie supervisor or rescue group supervisor, good, do it. Don't ask me for permission. Don't wait in line for the radio to be quiet enough to tell me what you're doing. Just do it, and make sure that we close that loop later. But in the moment, we can't afford to wait because, you know, the old adage that you get more power the more you give away, it couldn't be more true in modern incident command. So I think officers, what I've seen is that company officers that are led by a battalion chief who trains them, who trusts them, who empowers them on the fire ground, sees huge dividends in the firehouse the rest of the time. These are company officers that walk taller, that walk with their shoulders back, their head up, and are looking for and ready to take initiative on any number of things, whether it be disciplinary issues or maintenance issues around the station or training issues. They see themselves as officers instead of glorified babysitter / clipboard holding EMS providers. Those are all important things, but like you said, there's nothing like seeing your battalion come together on a fire where all that training pays off, all that hard work, all the training, the hard work, the discussions, the disagreements, the back and forth, where it just pays off, and it's a tremendously satisfying feeling.
The statement I absolutely love that you said was, in your experience, in your view of this, the decentralized concept increases command presence. And I think that that's probably absolutely true. It's, you know, much like Chief Castro's talks about, that using divisions and groups increases supervisors, which increases safety, versus having, you know, a safety officer that's just kind of hovering around the scene. Getting those guys closer, more supervision improves all that stuff. It's almost like, you know, to use the football analogy, the modern fire ground is the 2-minute offense. And that's not freelancing. You have just absolutely scripted this time-compressed thing as the coach. what you're giving them control over is the audibles, the slight adjustments, but the overall plan is set. Those 10 plays of your 2-minute offense are established and just grinded on in practice. So that way, none of that communication, those clear expectations are all set well ahead of that time where you have to deploy it.
And you know, that 2-minute offense is basically when you're in a rescue mode and you have confirmed victims trapped, you're in a 2-minute offense. You're in the offensive strategy. You're going to be aggressive with your fire attack. You're going to be aggressive with your search. And you have a limited amount of time, and you have to be in a hurry if you're going to affect the rescue, if you're going to do it within the time frame. And from your work with Firefighter Rescue Survey, when we now know that the highest chance of survival for a civilian victim is 6 minutes from arrival of the fire department. And granted, you're going to have various response times. But once you get there, you've got about 6 minutes to get that victim out of the toxic environment on into medical care if they're going to walk out of the hospital one day. That's a 2-minute offense.
You know, the Chief, I believe that you and Chief Viscuso spoke about, it was a while back on another, I think on the same podcast, but it was about missed transition. You know, that expanded presence with all contributing members kind of pointed in the same direction will help to alleviate that problem of those missed transitions. It's just a really invaluable tool.
It's paramount. The tactical supervisor has an opportunity to lead from the middle. You know, they have the opportunity to see more than the incident commander does, can respond more quickly, can see the risks, can act in real time face-to-face much more efficiently and quickly than an incident commander, but they're also able to forecast better than the crews in the task level hot zone that can't see their hand in front of their face, that are just head down working. They're the ones that really make it or break it, and you can't do that if you're not empowered for those ideas and decisions. Hey, well, for those of you just joining us, thank you. We're talking to with new host Brian Brush and Mike Emilio from Oklahoma City Fire, talking about decentralized idea-making and decision-making and command. And we're also talking about some of the statistics from Firefighter Rescue Survey to help us be more effective and efficient on the fire ground when it comes to civilian rescue. We just kind of talked about the 2-minute drill and the 2-minute offense and how that really requires a lot of empowerment by the boss, whether the boss is a head coach or an incident commander on the part of the troops on the field. So let's talk about some classes coming up, Calm the Chaos, Train the Trainer. We've been doing that all around the country. It's been crazy. We love it. We'll come to you, and you get all of the simulations, PowerPoints, videos, student instructor guides, and we'll come to you and do hands-on training, smoke machines, live companies, multi-company drills, hose lines, SCBAs, we're doing rescues, we're doing maydays, we're doing all kinds of scenarios. Go to our website at trainfirefighters.com to look get some more information. We're going to be in Contra Costa County, California, Fresno, California, Oklahoma City will be February 28th through March 4th. If you're interested in coming to the operational workshop, it's 2 days. It's just an operational workshop. Great time. It's February 28th. And 29, it is a leap year. That'll be in Oklahoma City, Midwest City area of Oklahoma. And we'll be doing it again in Salinas and coming up later in the year in Omaha, Nebraska in June. So, again, go visit us at trainfirefighters.com or email us at info@trainfirefighters.com for more information on bringing this incident command, Train the Trainer, to you. We're also going to be coming out with a new online version of the operational level course. That's going to be exciting. It's coming out by the first of the year. Going to be a big deal. And you can use your AFG grant to pay for it. The AFG grant process, the application process is currently now open. It's open until the 5:00 December 17th this year. So you can join the departments that have used grant funding to pay for this training. It's been tremendously successful for many departments. We hope you reach out to us and bring us to your agency and look at using an AFG grant. Okay, with that, let's talk a little bit more, Brian, about firefighter rescue survey, you know, how many surveys to date have been done, and how the qualitative data, if you will, is coming across. Are the statistics still what we wrote about in our article in July? And also, how has decentralized idea and decision-making come to play with the statistics and the information you're seeing?
Well, can I back up just a little bit, Chief?
Sure.
I guess yes. Okay. Can we, Mike, would you mind telling us again the title? I know the title of the article, I believe, was Decentralized Decision Making or Idea Making, and what month it was so the guys can, people can look that up.
you're putting me, I believe it was on, it was the August issue. I'm mostly sure it was August. I just don't have my copy with me, and my computer's locked up, but I believe it was the August issue.
Yes,
and it was the last article. You can't miss it. Last article in the magazine.
Perfect. Yeah, the firefighter rescue survey, we're still clipping along. We've been trying to work in the background on getting the 5 years, now nearly 6 years of reports under one spreadsheet and kind of one source, so that way it's easier to sort through. That's taken a little bit more time than we had anticipated, but surveys are still coming in. Obviously, I think what we realized was that 2,000 rescue sample size is pretty much holding up. That number, almost all the trends, everything that we witnessed in that first 2,000 is just continuing to be reinforced as far as time of day, the areas where victims are being found, the means of which they're being removed. But a lot of that is helping drive kind of some new ways of handling even the training. More specifically, just Van Enter search training alone. Van Enter search training, it's kind of something that has started to become more widely accepted as a tactic. But as far as delays go, a lot of that initial inception was known victim, known location. We're starting to see more and more people use our information as far as speed of access and then removal to fresh air, changing those policies from known victim to known location to just almost Venator search being a means to get in and out of searchable spaces as quickly as possible. The other component of Venator search is, while it's frequently trained as one firefighter in, one firefighter observing, we are finding that removal of victims takes a full crew. And so I think we're definitely going to start modifying that in our search training to that operation being 2 to 3 people as far as the entry and the victim removal, and then a crew awaiting the receipt of that victim, especially if EMS is not on the scene. And you know, I think this is another good one to bring Mike back into the discussion on. I think you guys had actually Oklahoma City, maybe it was a couple years ago, Mike, a fire on the northwest side of town, a Van Enter search, where there was some hang up and a firefighter injury as a result of it falling from the ladder, as far as several firefighters involved in trying to get that person out of the window and a mass displacement.
Yes, sir. Yeah, it is something that I think we, again, going to realistic training, I think we've all taken that event to heart and kind of realized that we're going to have to take that extra step, throw that second ladder to give a bigger platform for carrying a potential victim down, but also to get more bodies involved on the interior. It is such a heavy process, and of course, everybody knows the state. I mean, people don't typically, go to sleep in full bunker gear, so it's very difficult to get a sleeping body or a body in the nighttime hours out of a home. So there are so many factors that event brought our way, and it's something that I think has changed a lot of the training modalities and tactical efforts that we've seen recently. I mean, I don't know that it can be emphasized enough that we're just never going to be really prepared for, say, a second division rescue of a downed victim. It's something that we can aim for, but the minute it comes, it's going to come with all of the problems that are unique to that situation. So we just have to make training and studying as realistic as we can possibly make it.
And Oklahoma City,
amen
is
to that,
Oklahoma City is one of the first departments in the country to spend a year collecting their rescue information. They basically took the rescue survey, internalized it, and now has, I think, last time I checked with Justin, over the last few years, a total of 44 rescues in your database from your own city, which is, you know, definitely a powerful tool to discuss training and drive training in the organization. And, you know, I think it's awesome that is making it not only to your crews on the shift, but also to your recruit classes and instilling that vigilance in them at an early period in their career.
Yeah, Chief, it really is. You know, it's become one of Lieutenant Justin Lorenzen's passions. He set the thing up and has really been a driving force behind it. And it really does allow the membership to see the good. It quantifies the good that we're doing. It also illuminates the areas that we can go faster and make better progress. And that's a really important thing as well. It teaches in kind of two directions. But, you know, it's unlocked. We had a particularly bad winter maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I can't remember. But it was a particularly bad winter where we had we were pulling a lot of people out of house fires. And those things, while they were a mixed bag as far as the end result, those things really kind of stoke inside a firefighter their true calling for this work. We want to be there for those people that in our communities, and so that kind of reinvigorated this effort to keep making grabs as a central focus. You know, I think we could almost cover up the word fire on the back of our T-shirts and just be the Oklahoma City Rescue Department, because I feel like fire attack and ventilation are just arms, support arms for the interior process of rescue. Because we do search every structure, those people on the inside need to be our people on the inside need to be cared for while they do that. And so I just feel like it's one of those things. It's one of those driving forces in that kind of cultural shift. I've been on the job for almost 20 years, 19 and some change, and I've had my hands on two actual victims that we brought out and hopefully they made a recovery. We got them where they needed to be for all the help that they could get. But and then countless other less successful, you know, efforts. But those two will always remain kind of at the front of my mind as a motivator, spurning motivator.
You know, I think we need to think holistically about rescue. Rescue is so it means different things to different people. I think Brian and I have found that out over the years, that when you say rescue, some people think that means the act of search and rescue, searching a room or doing VES. When you say rescue, other people think of it as the tactical priority on the as the highest tactical priority. And when we think about rescue, I think it's going to help us to think about it in a holistic term, meaning if the end goal is that somebody walks out of the hospital, then there's going to be a lot that has to happen for that person to walk out of the hospital. Obviously, fire prevention is a huge piece of it. But let's just assume that fire prevention, for whatever reason, didn't work. The smoke detector didn't have a battery. The sprinkler system wasn't in place. We're talking about a fire has started, fire prevention, while it's the most important proactive preventative tool to prevent any of this from happening, let's talk about when it doesn't work and we are responding to a fire. What do we do now? Well, it's rescue is the highest priority, but that doesn't mean that's not the physical task of searching a room. It means that is should be our highest objective, meaning that it could require fire attack. It could require the physical search or VES. It could require ventilation, and it's going to require probably medical intervention. All four of those things have to come into place and come into alignment so that that person walks out of the hospital. And the problem is the fire service is great because we have a lot of passionate people. Problem is we have a lot of passionate people. And what happens is people get fixated on one thing. Oh, fire attack's the most important. You got to take the heat out of the fire. You got to get the fire. You got to knock the fire out. Yeah, I know. I agree with you, person. And the next person says, oh, you got to get him out. You got to get him out. You got to rescue him. You got to rescue. Rescue the person. Yeah, I know. I agree with you, too. These all have to happen simultaneously. Those key four objectives, fire attack, search and rescue, ventilation, and getting him to medical and off the scene to the ER as soon as possible. None of them are mutually exclusive. None of them, not one of them is more important than the other. They're all important, and they all have to happen virtually simultaneously because that's the only way we're going to outpace modern fires, because we have to attack it exponentially because the fire grows so exponentially. And the only way to attack it exponentially is to decentralize your command, decentralize your decision-making, decentralize your ideas, decentralize your authority. That's the only way we can outpace the incident and save a civilian. And, by the way, save our own. Because all the while, we have this common denominator of our own life safety, of that of our troops. So this is a lot to put on the shoulders of one incident commander. And that's why I love the term in command, out of control. And that's a perfect term. What was the book? And who was the author again, Mike?
So it's I don't know. I read it. It was a quoted line in a book. I don't know that it's from a book, but it's General Paul Van Riper, U.S. Marine Corps. He was a strategic consultant when he retired. I believe he was retired, but he was a strategic consultant for a war game that went on in the late 90s, simulating a big fight I can't remember where the fight was supposed to take place, but it's General Paul Van Riper. I believe it's Riper. It could be Ripper, but it's one piece, so I think it's Riper.
I'm looking at him right now. Yeah, he looks like a badass.
Oh, I'm telling
he twice received the Silver Star for heroic actions in Vietnam. Still alive, 83 years old. We're going to find him. We're going to call on him.
He's a great guy. And, you know, I think that there are obviously a lot of correlations. I limit the number of, say, military influences I have in my library, but these guys like this, they're just indispensable. I mean, you can't get enough of them, so.
Well, and you know, fast forward to modern day Jocko Willink, you know, extreme ownership requires extreme empowerment, doesn't it?
Yes, sir.
You can't have extreme ownership without extreme empowerment. That's what you're talking about with your work. So that's the only way. That's the only way we can hit the ground running and exponentially outpace the incident to make a difference, because of all the different things that have to happen. And mind you, being mindful of the NIOSH 5. And all these are command functions, right? Sizing up the situation, getting the victim profile, making sure everyone on the fire ground should be able to state what the victim profile is. It shouldn't just be an officer. You know how we talk about kinks are everybody's problem. If you see a kink, kick it out. Well, we teach if you see a bystander, get a victim profile. Try and get a credible source. Find out what you can. And I love the question should be, you know, how do you know? And that's a great question about when you talk to a potential RP. They say, oh, there's so-and-so's inside. How do you know? Well, I think he's there. Well, that's not the same as that's my husband. I literally just got home. I know he's in there for a fact or whatever. And that's everybody's problem. That's if everyone else just head down working, they're not going to be heads up thinking. And those are the kinds of things that we need to emphasize to our firefighters, not just our officers, but of our firefighters and engineers, who are the most task saturated in the moment, who want to get the work done, who we need to get the work done, but who also are embedded in the incident and can see and potentially talk to people that have more information for us.
Yes, sir. I mean, the thing that we're kind of up against, not necessarily up against, but something that we could work toward maybe remedying, is that we spend so much time training for the event and we of rescue and we put hours and hours into it. And by and large, especially here in Oklahoma, we do have an excellent education department. Our fire educators they're second to none, and they do a great job of communicating the importance of smoke alarms and things like that. We have huge smoke alarm programs and things like that here in the city, free giveaways and installations and everything. But while that's great, that also means that a good majority of our folks get out of their homes, and they're kind of curbside when we get there. So what you kind of fight is a complacency toward that. You know, again, I 20 years on the job, two grabs that I can claim, so to speak. That's a pretty small percentage. You know, we have to kind of fight that and realistically train through the. Through that kind of lull in activity, so to speak, and still show up expecting to do that job at every fire alarm.
Yeah, and I do like that. You know, that the thing that hit me was when I broke down prevention, and the key word is pre-event. You know, that's where the success of those programs stop. But I mean, the other part of the firefighter rescue survey that. The biggest thing we're trying to determine is while fires are down, are rescues on the increase? And I think all the anecdotally we can say yes, because of the speed at which fires are developing and the threat of smoke and fires burn but smoke kills and the smoke is getting worse. So, I hope to message to the new firefighter that you guys will be in a career where you will experience more rescues than we ever have before. We're getting to these incidents quicker. We're going to have to be more involved, and we're going to see patients going down with a shorter exposure time to that smoke.
Yes. The it's funny that legacy is still kind of part of the vernacular. You know, I believe entirely in the fact that we fight fires in some legacy buildings and things, but our fires aren't legacy fires anymore, and so we've got to adjust that. We've got to almost eliminate that legacy vernacular and move on to, like you said, the more rapid response and the greater likelihood that we are going to encounter something on in a time where we can positively affect it.
Well, Jim, I think we could talk all night long because this is a big deal. But I want to thank you both, especially Brian, not only for joining me as our new co-host on the Command Show, but also for bringing Mike in tonight with his insights and his work on his article on decentralized idea and decision making. It's important stuff. And if we're going to outpace the fire ground, we can't be fascist at the command post. We need to decentralize, whether it's empowering your officers to make tactical decisions, give you ideas, or empower them to take on group and division supervisor roles and training them as such, victim profiling, and so forth. We have to outpace the incident, and the only way to do that is to beat it, is to be exponential in our actions, not sequential like we've been in the past, where we're all slave to one radio channel and one decision maker. And so with that, I want to remind everybody that if you want Calm the Chaos, Train the Trainer at your department, give us an email at info@trainedfirefighters.com. You can use AFG grant funding. We also have Mastering the Fire Service Assessment Center out online based on the book from Fire Engineering. You get the book, e-book with that. And we have a lot more coming next year in the form of online command classes. And sign up for the Oklahoma City Calm the Chaos Workshop, February 28, 29 next year. It's going to be great. It's going to be in Oklahoma City, and we hope to see you all there. You can register at trainedfirefighters.com. Gentlemen, do you have anything else to add before we close it out?
No, thank you, Mike, and thank you, Chief.
Yeah, same for me. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, both of you. It's been a real honor and a great pleasure.
Well, the honor's all ours, brother. And to all of you listening out there in the fire service, out in the world, God bless you, those you serve, and those you lead. Take care, everybody. Thank you.